Sir, good to see a few visitors here today. Appreciate it very much to see a few people on their way to the Feast of Tabernacles, I'm quite sure, and which is really great. That's on our minds now. We all got feast fever, I think. September the 22nd, 1956. My wife and I spent probably the loneliest Sabbath that we ever spent in all of our lives. You see, we were baptized the third day of September, 1956. Happened to be Labor Day. And after I was baptized and went down to Pasadena to do that at Pasadena headquarters, and after I dressed back into my regular clothes, why, walking back down with a man that baptized me, and he says, "Oh, incidentally, Thursday is a holy day." He says, "You be here." I looked at him and I said, "It's a what? What did you say?" I didn't know any more about what a holy day was than any other day, as far as I was concerned. I didn't know there was such a thing as a holy day at that stage. But I was baptized. And after I inquired to him about this matter of holy days a little bit, I was there that Thursday, and I've been to every one ever since, as far as that goes, that comes along the way. I think I did miss one time because I was ill a little bit one time and didn't get to go to just one of the days, and that's the only one I think I've ever missed all the way down through all those years from then on. But that Sabbath, September the 22nd, was the Feast of Trumpets. I mean, was the Sabbath after the days began. I should say the Feast of Trumpets was on the third day of September. I've got the notes down here. The Day of Atonement happened to be on the 15th day of September that year. And I was there. It happened to be on a Sabbath. That was the Saturday Sabbath and the High Day Sabbath. And being totally green, I didn't know anything about holy days. Suddenly everybody was gone after the Day of Atonement. And my wife and I were the loneliest people you could ever see on that next Sabbath because there was nobody there. We missed that Sabbath. And I don't believe we've ever missed one after that, as far as that goes, because we went all the time after that on the Sabbath attendance. And that was a little bit difficult because it was about 60 miles of stop signs between San Bernardino and Pasadena back in those days. There was no interstates yet. And but we did it. We went there every Sabbath all the time. We were so lonely after that first one, and we didn't learn at that time what all of this was all about. We didn't have time. But we soon learned, I can assure you. I inquired about all of these things and learned a lot about it, and when I questioned all of these things, we started psyching up for the next feast that was to come the next year. And we had our children and ourselves all keyed up for that next feast, and I can assure you we really enjoyed that one because I learned how God intended that we ought to do it. Now, I think that's something that maybe we ought to talk about today is about the way we ought to attend the Feast of Tabernacles, because that's a subject on all of our minds right now. We learned very early the value of the holy days as it pictures God's plan all the way through for mankind. And the most important of all of those then, because of the condensed togetherness at the Feast of Tabernacles, is the one that seems to draw everybody together more perfectly than any of the rest of them. 8 days to deeply drink in of the understanding of what it's all about, the knowledge of God's plan for mankind. We soon learned the expression that we have used every year, all the time, ever since. Boy, this was the best feast ever. Well, I hope you're looking forward to this one as being that too. The best feast ever. Because we should. We should grow in these things and see them as developing better and better as the time goes on, and more especially in these times in which we live. I think you realize that the things that have been happening in these last few weeks are absolutely traumatic events, some of which are, we've never had the likeness of before. I don't ever remember of any knowledge of any tsunami that ever came like that one we had that wiped out all of those people here some time ago. And that horrible, horrible earthquake. How would they ever estimate how many people are killed? You know, they don't even take a census over there, as far as I know. They don't know how many people are there to start with. How would they know how many are killed? I don't know how they'd go at it. They just have to make a wild guess. And I think probably they have information where they can make a fairly decent evaluation for a guess. But that's really all it is. You know, when you have an earthquake and shakes the mountains down to where the landslides have covered whole towns, you know how many people are there. That's a horrible situation, brethren. Beyond our imagination, I know that. I can't imagine the horror of all of that. We had a terrible situation here in the United States when Katrina came out. And when that was about 4 days out there in the Gulf, I told my wife at that time, I said, look, I lived down in Beaumont, Texas for 4.5 years. And I went over to New Orleans several times because the district superintendent lived over there, and I'd go over there for meetings when we'd have meetings. And I said, I was down in that bowl. And I said, if that hurricane comes and floods all that area, that will be a catastrophe like we have never, ever seen before here. I'm setting up here, way up here, and I know that. Why on earth didn't they load up all of those multitudinous school buses? They had 500 of them in one lot down there that was washed under. How many lots they had, I don't know. But they had, I think, 500 buses that were ruined by the floods. Why didn't they load those up? Anybody could drive a bus in an emergency like that and get out of there. I know it's easy to be a money-earning quarterback, all of this kind of thing, but it was so silly to me that they didn't make more preparation for that, knowing that it could happen, and did. They had studies to prove that it could. Well, we've had these tremendous things, not to even mention the next one that came along, Rita, right behind it, and caused some more flooding down there. I am not trying to prophesy at all. I gave a sermon about that. I said it looks like it's at least a possibility that these could be the beginnings of the sorrows that are to come that Christ talked about when he was asked the question of what would be the signs of the time of your coming and the end of the age. Now, he said all of these are the beginnings of sorrows. I wonder if we aren't in the beginnings, and if we are, then they're going to me, the very expression would indicate that it's going to continue to get worse and worse and worse, and we see more and more and worse catastrophes hitting. In a way, I hope that's not true. I hope I missed the mark completely on that, in one sense of the word. But in the other sense of the word, brethren, it is going to happen. Jesus said so. He said there will be a time coming whenever before his, when he was asked the question, there will be a time like there's never, ever, ever been on the face of the earth when mankind is on it. A worst tribulation that has ever come upon mankind, and there'll never be another one. Now, I don't know if we're approaching that or not, but I know one thing about it. We better be ready for anything that's going to come. Because that time is going to come, whether I'm there or not. I'm, in a way, kind of happy that I'm 84 years old and sort of out of, I don't think I'm going to last all that long as far as that goes. But I want to be ready even if it comes right away. And I hope you are too. Now, Feast of Tabernacles. We're going there. And we learned that going to the Feast of Tabernacles, an awful lot of it is what you make of it yourself. And I think you know what I mean. Most of you do, certainly, know what I mean. I've made my mistakes along the way, practically all of them, I guess. I didn't think anybody could make some of the stupid mistakes I've made. On the other hand, we have gone to the feast, what, since 1957, never missed a year from that time on. We didn't go to 56 because I was ignorant, didn't know how to go, didn't know what to do, how to make it. I had no preparation for going to the Feast of Tabernacles that year, even though I was baptized. So it was a feast that I observed, but I observed it at home because I didn't know any better at that stage. So there's a lot of feasts that I've been to as far as that goes. And I've probably made every mistake in the book in one sense of the word somewhere along the way. But I've also seen others that have gone there and seen some of the mistakes that they make. And it's been my job for, what, ever since 1963 especially, or even before that, because, 1962, for example, I happened to be given the responsibility to be in charge of the parking at Squaw Valley. Well, 1962, the parking up there was just our own cinders. There was no blacktop at all in the parking area. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Squaw Valley. It's a very nice, high area feast site as far as that goes. It's where the Olympic Games were played back in when? The 40s or 50s? I'm not even sure exactly when they were played there. But that was the auditorium in which we met. And there was, I think, about 11,000 people came up there those first couple of years. And sitting there in that open auditorium where the whole end was open to see all of the ski slides out there and all of that, it wasn't too warm in that place, I can assure you. And we had some very uncomfortable places to attend the feast. Even as Big Sandy was when we had to meet in that huge building out there when there was no air conditioning or anything like that. And when it got up to around 100 degrees, why, it was pretty miserable in there on the other side of the fence, being sweaty and hot and miserable. But how do you keep a right attitude in that sort of thing? An attitude of rejoicing that God tells us we ought to do. Well, I want to talk about that a little bit today. I know and realize that God tells us the one mark that designates His people is this very day, the Sabbath. Turn to Exodus 31. Let's read that. The 31st chapter of Exodus and verse 13. I hope you all know the verse so well right off. So I turned to Exodus 31 instead of, that's what I want, Exodus 31 and verse 13. I can't find it. I got to have, you know, I'm getting old. I can't help that. I can't stop it somehow. Exodus 31 and verse 13. Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths. Note that's in the plural. My Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you. It is a sign. That is, the keeping of my Sabbaths, plural, is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal who sanctifies you. And you shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it's holy. Now you could turn, and I think we ought to turn to Ezekiel, the 20th chapter, which, of course, is another place where this same thing is mentioned there. Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 12, where God inspired the prophet Ezekiel to write, "Moreover, I also gave them my Sabbaths," plural, "to be a sign between me, between them and me, that they might know that I am the Eternal that sanctifies them." Now, the house of Israel didn't observe them, and they failed to do it, but they were given the instructions to do it and to keep it that way. Keep those Sabbaths. Now, how about the holy days? What got that to do with the holy days? Let's go back to Exodus 23. Now, that's the holy day chapter, you know. Exodus 23. I said Exodus 23. I know the holy day chapter is Leviticus 23, and so do you, I think. Leviticus 23, please. Leviticus 23 and verse 1. "And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, These feasts," now we're talking about the feasts, "these feasts of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Now, which is the first one that's mentioned? Verse 3, 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath. And then the Sabbath is one of those feasts. That's what God says. First one mentioned, the Sabbath, is the Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work in it. It is the Sabbath to the Eternal in all of your dwellings. Now, that's the first one, and he enumerates the rest of them as we go on through the chapter. I'm not going to wade through it all. I just want to read verse 4, though, to pick up the... "These are the feasts of the Eternal, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times." At their appointed times, year by year, then that would be it is. You know, you have an appointed time that's your birthday. Now, that comes only once a year, of course. And but on the 14th day of the first month, and that first month comes each year, of course, the first 14th day of the, at twilight is the Eternal's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, these are the feasts he's talking about all the way through here. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. Oh, I know there have been discussions about whether you are commanded to eat unleavened bread every day of those 7 days or not. And Mr. Armstrong always said long ago, if there was a reason, a proper reason for fasting on that day, well, then you wouldn't have to eat unleavened bread on that day. But otherwise, all the rest of the time, you should eat unleavened bread on those days, on those particular days. I know that was the teachings from all the way back, and I keep going on. I'm not going to read down through all of the rest of these holy days. I don't think I need to. I didn't want to do that. They're commanded to be kept, though, forever. And we read verses 26 through 32, I think, on the Day of Atonement, day before yesterday, went across that. They're all mentioned, and then the eighth day of the feast is mentioned as the last great day, covering all seven of the feasts that fall annually during the year. In addition to the Sabbath being the first feast that God mentions in the feast chapter. So those are the feasts that the Eternal has commanded us to keep. Now, back in 1956, I was dumb. I didn't know enough to figure out how to go to the feast. I didn't know how to make preparations for that. Sorry about that, but I didn't. And so I stayed home. But I learned that there is a way that I could finance going to the feast. Turn to Deuteronomy 14, and let's see that. Deuteronomy, the 14th chapter, and I'll start in verse 22. Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. Now, I had already started tithing quite a some time before I ever was baptized, as far as that goes. But I never even knew that I'm supposed to eat one of them. You know, that was interesting to me. You shall truly tithe all the increase of the field, the grain that the field produces year by year. So it's to be done every year, year by year, as opposed to the one tithe that is to be kept twice in the seven-year period. And that's later in here, and I'm not going to discuss that today. That's not my purpose. But this year-by-year tithe is to be kept every year. And verse 23 says, you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place which he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe. You're supposed to eat this tithe. That's what he says. Eat it. The tithe of your grain and of your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and of your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. You know, it's interesting that we have a big problem with oil today as far as that goes. And, you know, the price of gasoline out here has gone skyrocketed in one sense of the word. And we a problem with oil. But oil has been a commerce item that was used, but that was olive oil back in those days. And they used it in a lot of ways, as far as that goes. But not like we use it. They didn't use that in burning their gas tanks, I'm pretty quite sure, or their diesels either. But oil today. I talked to my son last week, and I mentioned this about oil, and he says, Dad, do you know that in Brazil, they almost quit using oil? I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, they burn alcohol. He said, they have manufactured their automobiles. That's what my son told me. And I don't know where he got this, but, you know, in his business, he gets information from a lot of places. And it was undoubtedly, he doesn't just swallow this stuff hook, line, and sinker either. But he said that they make their automobiles today in Brazil with computerized, as ours are, you know, they're all computerized today. And that computer will tell that carburation system on that automobile whether it's burning alcohol or whether it's burning gasoline or any mixture of these, either one of these in between, and it adjusts for that automatically in the computer system. And I said, that is incredible. I never heard of this kind of stuff before. He said they make alcohol out of sugar cane, mainly, down there. And it's a very relatively inexpensive process. And so their fuel for their automobiles doesn't cost nearly as much as gas prices. Now, you think the oil companies are not aware of this? They're aware of it. And they're shaking a little bit about it, too. Now, I say that because I'm not in that business. And I'm not going to design any of that stuff as far as that goes. I'm out of the engineering field since 1963 and haven't done anything in it anymore. But that was interesting to me that the oil industry is taking a little bit different shape in some parts of the world at any rate. And it seems like we ought to be able to get some of those cars up here. No, I don't know whether we would or should or shouldn't. Where did I get stopped? In verse 23 of Exodus 14. Then verse 24 says, but if the journey is too far from you, now you're to save the tithe of all of your animals, the firstborns of your animals, and the first fruits of your crops, but what if the distance is a little bit far? You can't haul a whole great big bunch of grain up there to or produce of the land as a tithe or your all of your animals long distance to get to the feast. Verse 24 says, if the journey is too long for you, so that you're not able to carry the tithes, and that's what they tithed back in those days, was the tithe of their produce of the land, animals and the crops. Or if the place where the eternal your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. And of course, that's almost the way we have to live today, because we don't have that many farmers in total. We have a few, but we don't have all that many that would have that produce in the first place. And so we commonly realize that we have to exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the eternal your God chooses. Now, that money is from that tithe, obviously, because that's what he's subject. That's the whole subject here. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. So if you desire to have a shot of drugs or something like that, go ahead and have it, because that's what it says, anything your heart desires. Come on. You know, people like to twist God's word that way sometimes. And that's the reason I mentioned it. I'm glad I got a laugh, because that is not in the slightest what God is talking about here. Not in any way, shape, or form. You see, people twist scriptures sometimes to mean things like that, and it's just stupid to do that. God never would do that, to advise anybody to take stuff that was illegal. You spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drinks, for whatever your heart desires. But it doesn't tell you to go out and get drunk either. We shouldn't drink to excess at the feast or anywhere else, for that matter. But it's not wrong to have a glass of wine. It isn't unusual for me to have a glass of wine with my dinner maybe several times a week. That's no problem. Small glass of wine, I think it's good for you. But I don't get drunk with it, I can assure you. Wine or strong drinks, or whatever your heart desires, and you shall eat there before the eternal your God, what? Of those oxen and sheep, and it's nice to have a nice big steak. And if you save your tithes properly, then maybe you can afford a good steak sometimes when you wouldn't be able to afford it some of the other times during the year. And you can enjoy this. Now that's getting into the area of what God intends for us to do. You shall eat there before the eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. And you shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. And that was the way they were structured back then. The Levites were the tribe that took care of the temple and instructions of the law and so forth, all of these various things. That was the responsibility of the Levites. You know, back at that time, he couldn't say, turn to Leviticus 23 and read thus and such, because they didn't have it that way. They had it written out in scrolls, and they were very, very expensive, and the people didn't have that. I didn't say they were ignorant and couldn't read, because they didn't have an opportunity. They weren't educated. They weren't educated in these things. And so it wasn't that they didn't have an opportunity to do it, but the Levites had the responsibility of being the teachers, the ones to maintain the temple, and to do all of the various items that needed to be done in relationship to the worship of God as far as the temple is concerned. That was the Levite tribe. Now, Levites, they all had the tithes. That's the law of God. But where did the tithes of the Israelites go? Well, from the 11 tribes, Levi was one of the tribes, you know, that was the 12th tribe. But from the 11 other tribes, that all went to the Levites. Now, I want you to think about that. The people that sent the tithes in had 9% of their income remaining. But how many did the Levites have? They had 11 tents because he had tents from all of the 11 tribes. Kind of interesting. I just thought I'd mention that because a lot of times we don't think about that kind of stuff. I don't mean they misused it now. I'm not even implying that. That's not the point. They had it for the maintenance of the things that they needed to do, and to the maintenance of the temple and the maintenance of keeping the laws of God and the instructions to go with it. I'm going to turn to Nehemiah because I want to read a little passage here. Nehemiah, the 8th chapter. And I want to read in verse 1. Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 1. It says, "Now all the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate, and they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded Israel." They didn't have it available for everybody to have and just roll open the scrolls and read it. If they had been educated to read at all, which most of them weren't, because those facilities weren't available at that time. That didn't mean they were dumb. They had knowledge and capability, I think, that would be so outstanding it would shock us because of their level of intelligence back in those days compared to what we have degenerated down to in our day. Excuse me, but I'll say it that like it is. But they didn't have the books. They had to learn from the scribes teaching them from the books, the law of Moses, which the Eternal had commanded Israel. Verse 2. "So Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of the men and women, and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month." Well, the first day of the, what's that? What's that? First day of the seventh month. Feast of Trumpets. Always, first day of the seventh month. "And he read from it in the open square," verse 3 says, "that was in front of the water gate, from morning until midday, before the men and women, and those who could understand, and the ears of all of the people were attentive to the book of the law." They paid attention to that. Now, if I listen to a lecturer for about an hour or so, after that I begin to get a little edgy and I'm not really as attentive as I should be anymore. I know that. But they listened from early morning until noon, midday, right on down the line, and they got it, apparently. They listened. That is incredible. They didn't have the books like we have to read it in the way we have. So that's how they had to learn it. Now, verse 4 says, "The scribe stood on the platform of wood which was made for the purpose. And beside him at his right hand stood these other Levites that were there with him in order to do the teaching of all of these things." I'm not going to read all of those verses. You can read them. I'll drop down to verse 9. Drop down to verse 9 in that chapter. Nehemiah 8 and verse 9. "And Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites, who taught the people, said to all of the people, 'This day is holy to the Eternal your God. Do not mourn nor weep.'" Now they were weeping and mourning because of some of the trials and problems that they had there, because of going there and building the wall of Jerusalem and building the temple. And whenever they found out that they weren't keeping the law of God in the way that it should be from what Ezra read in the law of God, that made them mourn and weep too. "For all of the people wept when they heard the words of the law." Verse 10. "Then he said to them, 'Go your way, eat the fat.'" Well, you're not supposed to eat fat, are you? He says eat fat. Now, it doesn't mean lard, or it doesn't mean the fat off of a fat cow or a fat animal or something like that. It doesn't mean that. It means the good things that are there to eat. The appropriate good items of food. That's what it literally means when you look the word up. You should eat the fat or eat the good food. Let's see. Lost my place there, didn't I? Oh, verse 10. Go your way, eat the fat, and drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to the eternal. Do not sorrow. It'd be nice if we could go always and never sorrow about anything that goes along with some of these things that happen. I've been to the feast a lot of times, and I've been in all kinds of various positions. I said that in 1962 I was in charge of parking at Squaw Valley, and I believe it rained the first 4 days that we were there that time, and the parking was right out on cinders at that time. There were no marks or anything, no blacktop there to park on. And it rained for about 4 days, and these men out there directing all this parking out in the rain. And then that next night it snowed, and it snowed about 9 inches. Now you got a problem with parking out in the cinders and everything. And you know, there could be a few bad attitudes coming in along the way with that kind of thing whenever everything gets sort of clogged up over things like that. I had an excellent crew, and I'm so grateful for that. They did a marvelous job of handling all that parking situation into that time. But once in a while, you could find someone with a little bit of a bad attitude about some of those things. These things happen, brethren. They're natural. They come. And it happens. But he said, do not sorrow. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the eternal is your strength. We should be joyful in the Feast of Tabernacles and have that frame of mind and attitude. That's the important facet of this. That's my intent for today, is to teach us that we need to go there and have the right frame of mind and attitude, to be in a joyful frame of mind and attitude, and not full of sorrow. And we have all kinds of things that happen. I've met all kinds of various problems in the Feast of Tabernacles. I remember one time I was helping with the housing situation and helping people get to their various quarters and so forth. And pretty soon here were a couple of ladies came up, and they were sent to me because I was to help them get there. And they were about ready to pull each other's hair. I mean, one person said, well, I was assigned this place, and here she is. She's already moved in it. Well, she says, I was assigned to it, and here's the assignment. And they both had the assignment for the same place. And I mean, they were about ready to pull hair there. And I said, well, I think maybe we can solve this. And I smiled at them and talked to them very gently. And they kind of simmered down. And we went over to the housing station over there and showed them the problem. They said, oh, well, horror, we made a mistake on that. We'll fix that up. Don't worry about it. And we got this lady into another place that was just fine, and everything was lovely after that. But you see, you run into that, and when you come head to head with it, why, this is my place, you know, you get out of here. No, it wasn't quite that way. Well, these attitudes perhaps happen to pop up at times when situations like that arise. I only mention that because I could mention all kinds of various things that happen. I guess I'll never forget one. I believe it was one of the first years. Probably 58 or 59, somewhere along in there. I went to Big Sandy in those years. And I was assigned to be out assisting in the traffic coming into the park, into the areas. And one guy drove up, and he just touched the bumper of the other car. Back in those days, those old cars, those bumpers were pretty sound on them too. And you know, it's not like these things today where you touch this car and it'll dent it. But those were pretty sound bumpers they had on there that day. Well, it irritated this guy in front. Somebody bumped him from behind. And so I can't think of the man's name now, but he weighed about 350 pounds or something like this. And he was a deacon out there. And he walked over to this car where this guy was getting a little bit irritated about this. And it was Ken Swisher's father-in-law, and I can't remember his name now, but he was the man. He died since, long since, but he weighed about 350 pounds, and he walked up to this car, and he put his foot up on the running board, and the car went down about that far, you know. And he said, "You got a little problem here," or something like that. Well, it just solved the problem in a hurry right there. I'll never forget that, I don't think. I laughed about that at the time that it happened. There was no problem anymore after that. They both went in and got parked and everything was lovely. These things happen, that's all I'm trying to say. And they come along, and we are people. And we have those things happen to us. We have trained ourselves from way back to do that at times. You know, to look out for ourselves, we have to in this world in which we live, particularly. But we don't always have the mind of Christ when it comes to that kind of thing. When things pop up, why, sometimes we do get in the wrong attitude. Be careful about that. That's what I'm saying, brethren. We need to be careful about that and make sure that we are joyful at God's Feast of Tabernacles. That's what He wants us to do. Where did I stop here in verse 10 of Leviticus, of Nehemiah 8? Then he said, "Go your way, eat of that." No, I read that. Verse 11, the Levites quieted. Verse 11 says, they quieted all of the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." Don't be grieved by all of this. And all the people went their way to eat and to drink and to send portions and rejoice greatly. God commands us to rejoice at the feast. That's what we're supposed to do. Now, as I said, things do happen, and they come along. And so it's the Levites' responsibility then to try to keep everything on the up and up. And I've been in that position as far as not a Levite. I'm not a Levite, but, you know, Jesus Christ changed the priesthood, that is, He was the high priest, wasn't even from the tribe of Levi, see, he was from the tribe of Judah, but he is our high priest, and under his ministry. And I've been in that for a lot of times, and I've had to try to quiet down some of these little situations that arise too. The Levites quieted the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." And all the people went their way to eat and drink and to send portions and rejoice greatly because they understood the words that were declared to them. They were commanded to rejoice. We need to recognize that and realize it as far as we are concerned. So, what kind of an impression should we leave then when we go around among all of the people of this world, wherever we may be? No, your attitude is so vitally important. You know, I kept the feast of many years in the Worldwide Church of God, or Radio Church of God first, before there was a Worldwide, and then it became the Worldwide Church of God. And everywhere where we have a feast, when we have a go into a major city and a number of people go there, the business places and all of the people around always comment on the frame of mind and attitude that they see in God's people when they're there. That's beautiful, brethren. That's the way it ought to be. Now, does that mean there's never a bad attitude? No. We can get upset, and we're all human, and we can. Now, as I said, I've made probably all the mistakes in the world as far as that goes. I've had situations where I could get in a bad attitude all right very easily if I would let myself, but I've kind of been a little bit converted since all of that time. And have gotten out of doing that quite so often. I don't do that so easily anymore. Our witness is so important. You know, the very last thing that Jesus Christ told his disciples before he was ascended, 40 days after he was resurrected? Let's turn to Acts, the first chapter, and read that. Acts, the first chapter. And I think that's verse 8 that I want here of this. The very, very last words that Jesus spoke to his disciples at that time, in Acts 1, verse 8, "But you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you." They did. They received that power. So much so that the Apostle Peter could walk down the street and his shadow went over the sick and they were healed. That's incredible power. "And you shall be witnesses." What kind of witnesses shall we be? "You shall be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth." Period. Unquote. Verse 9. "And when he had spoken these things, while they watched, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight." Last words that Jesus told his people, be a decent witness. Be a witness to the world. Be a witness to the Gentiles. Be a witness to everybody. And we, as a church, have been witnesses in various places around the world, wherever our feast sites are held. I know all of you have known that, and I'm so grateful for that, to be frank about it, that God's people are generally good witnesses wherever they go. Now, as I said, there's always been a few incidents, and I'm not going to cite those because it seems like they have to arise occasionally. Anytime you have a cross-cut of people, well, you're going to find this to be true. There's got to be a problem once in a while. But that's not the main. The main idea is that you people are generally good witnesses in that respect. Now you're doing what you're commanded to do. And Jesus said when we did do what we're commanded to do, then we're going to say, well, I'm an ungrateful, I'm an unfaithful servant. That's about it. We do what we're supposed to do, and that is to rejoice at God's feasts. We should do that, certainly. I have quoted so often the passage in Psalm 119, 165. I'm going to turn to that. Now, I mentioned this verse, Psalm 119, 165. I hope everybody knows what it says before I ever turn to it. But I had a lady. You know, it's always, it seems to be the case, somewhere along the way, when you're a church pastor, you have certain people that incessantly call you because it seems like every day they've got another problem or something like that, and they call you over and over and over, which is fine. That's what we're there for. I'm not against that, but it's there always seems to be one person that has more problems than all the rest of the congregation put together, it seems like. In a way, and I had a lady like that up in New Jersey when I was up there. And she would call me sometimes, several times a day. And, which is all right, you know, if she had the problem, why, that's all right, I was the place to go. And she got to the place where when she would call me, she would start laughing and she'd say, okay, you're going to quote Psalm 119, 165. She could see it before I ever got turned to it. I said, yep, you got it. You memorized that. She did. Psalm 119, 165. It says, great peace have those who love your law. Great peace have those who love your law. I would tell her that over and over and over and over again. And I'm reading from the New King James Version of the Bible here now, and it says, and nothing causes them to stumble. Now, what does the New King James says? Great peace have they that love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. That's what the original King James says. Nothing shall offend them. Nothing? Sometimes things get a little bit offensive, you know. And we can be touched. Well, we've got to learn not to be. They didn't dissuade Jesus Christ with anything that would bother him. Now, he didn't put up with everything either. He told those scribes and Pharisees right straight to their face what they were, a bunch of hypocrites. And he didn't deny it either. But he loved them enough to die for them. And we know that. So, great peace have they that love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. No, nothing will cause them to stumble, as the New King James says. It shouldn't cause us to stumble at all. What are we saying? We need to have our frame of mind and attitude psyched up to the place where we're able to take anything like that, irrespective of what comes. And we should be that way. Then we won't find it easy to be offended. That's simply the way it is. If you do make a mistake, please have the fortitude to repent and change it right then and there. And we have to learn that also. I know that. I'm well aware of that. So that it's never repeated again. We need to get rid of it. I know that sometimes we can be reached even when we are close to God. No question about that. Now, there are reasons for some of those things, too. In Acts, the 20th chapter, I'm going to turn to that this time. Acts chapter 20. Here the Apostle Paul met with the ministry, and they were so sorry about it all because he said, "You're not going to see my face again." And they wept over this. But he said something in verse 29 about all of this, that he said, "I think it'd be good for us to take to heart." It says, "For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock." Savage wolves are not very gentle to the flock, as you very well know. If he jumps into a flock of sheep. "Also from among yourselves men will rise up, speaking perverse things." For what reason? It's right there. "Not sparing the flock, and from among yourselves they're speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after themselves." Now, when Mr. Armstrong died, the church was all went haywire. You know that, and I want to know that. Frankly, I was organizationally oriented then. I really was. And I felt like that had to be the one right organization at that time. And I had to learn a lesson. Brethren, your relationship with God comes first. First and foremost, above everything. Irrespective of what organization it is. Now, I say that, I don't want you sitting out here all by yourself saying, "Well, I don't go with anything then." That's not what I'm saying whatsoever. I didn't have any illusions. I don't want to sit out here all by myself. I love you people. I want to be with you. But I don't want to feel like I have to lead you because somebody else is running you astray. I don't want to do that. And that's what that verse tells me, that some are drawn to draw away disciples after themselves. Now, I don't want to do that, even if the organization that I represent does that. I still don't want to do it as far as that goes. And I don't think the organization I represent does that. I don't mean to say it that way. It was the intent of any intent like that. But that shouldn't be. We shouldn't have that frame of mind and attitude. Your attitude and frame of mind toward God is so vital. When you stand before Christ and he asks you about some of these things, you'll say, "Well, Mr. Michnick said," "I don't care what Mr. Michnick said. What do you think?" What do you think? You see, you need to have it within yourself. Internalize these things within yourself. Then no one can ever lead you astray. And I think that's what the Apostle Paul is saying here in this passage. We need to recognize that. We need to put on the armor of God. I hope you know the verse, the passage that tells you that. Ephesians, the 6th chapter. Let's turn to it. Ephesians, the 6th chapter, starting in verse 8. Or verse 10. I'll start in verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, and they will be there. You can rest assured of that. He's going out to get you if he can. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, nor against principalities and against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God. You see, demons are rampant. They're everywhere. You can rest assured of that. They're going to be out to get you. If they ever get you started down the trail, get a long bad attitude, boom, they can just keep piling it on then. And the farther it goes, the worse it gets. I know most of us have experienced that at one time or another and had to ask God to please rebuke all of that and get rid of that. Put on that armor of God. Verse 13, therefore take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And if there ever was an evil day, which there was once, you know, and God destroyed the whole earth except for save for 8 people. But there's going to be a time worse than that, he says. Do you realize that? There will be a time that's worse than that one because he said there's never been one like that before and there will never be another one. Drowning is a simple death in one sense. Easy death. Apparently it's not going to be that easy the next time. And it's going to be worse. The worst time it's ever been, and there'll never be another one. That you'll be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done to all, to stand. Won't be easy. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth. Here's the truth, right in this book. And you know how to find it, as far as that goes. Stand therefore having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness. And we may need armor coating, you know, to keep from being shot through. And having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, so that you can get out of there if need be, or face it if need be, have the feet to travel. And above all, taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And we'll need to quench those fiery darts because they will surely be there. And take the helmet of salvation. Need your head protected too. And the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. We ought to have that sword good and sharp, the Word of God. Know what it says and be ready with it. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. Being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplications for all the saints. We need to pray for one another, certainly. And all the saints. Now we do. And we ask prayer for various ones in various situations. And we should do that. When we go to the feast, then, we should rejoice. And rejoice at God's feast and be the kind of witnesses we should be. Because let's not be ignorant of Satan's devices. 1 Peter 5:8. the fifth chapter of 1 Peter and verse 8. Hopefully you all know what that verse says. Be sober. 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. Be sober. Be vigilant. Vigilant. Watchful. Be careful to be watchful. Look out, in other words. Because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Seeking whom? Anyone he can devour. If he ever gets you started on a trail, look out. Because he'll pile it on then. Seeking anyone he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. Not unique. He's not going to attack you in ways he wouldn't attack somebody else. He'll attack you in any way that he thinks just might find a little weakness. And if you can find that little weakness, then he'll build on that. And you can rest assured of that. He's dealt with mankind ever since Adam. And that's been a long time and lots of practice dealing with mankind. And he has the capability of doing that. So let's don't be ignorant of his devices. He's seeking those that he can devour. Well, the Feast of Tabernacles should be the place where we have the different kind of a conduct. A conduct that is open and clear and a good representation of God and what he represents in our sight. If we truly and properly are prepared in that way and have the right frame of mind and are psyched up so that we'll know that, then we can be ready to say that this was the best feast ever.